Okay, this is the interactive portion of the hour. This is where we take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Jerry Corsi with us. We're going to take your phone calls in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM as well. And this truly unbelievable story, when you think of what has happened, what has gone down, how much we have lost within ourselves over the past 50 years, Jerry. 50 years.
Yes, you're right, George. And it's why, when I was writing this book on, you know, who really killed Kennedy, the answer, it was not a history answer. It's not a history lesson. It's who we've become. And what I'm saying is, if you want to understand how the, you know, the CIA, the New World Order crowd is moving beyond borders, beyond the United States, it started the day Jack Kennedy was killed, with the international intelligence agency's agenda. Kennedy would not go along with the war in Vietnam. He did not go along in Laos. He did not go along in attacking Cuba. And Kennedy was in the way of where the New World Order crowd wanted to go. He had to be eliminated.
Well, and eliminate they did.
Yes, they did.
And they didn't. They never stopped. Do you think they also killed Martin Luther King Jr.?
No doubt about it. Same group, same kinds of motivations. Those who come out too strongly and are championing freedom in a individual or true sense, and Martin Luther King certainly did, are dangerous to those who want the intelligence agencies, the NSA, to be in control, no one to speak out of turn, no one to challenge the authority. You know, we've become a form of the Orwellian New World Order. We've become what the Nazis would have loved to have had. An intelligence agency-dominated state with a secret NSA wiretapping every conversation, and anyone who comes out of line being investigated or otherwise exposed.
Jerry, you know, also when we look at this, most of those people that were part of this, they're dead now, aren't they?
Yes, most are dead. There's still some who are alive, but most are dead. And but yet, their legacy lives on. And the CIA has, I think, was in Kennedy's time a rogue agency. I think today it's still a rogue agency. I think the New World Order has advanced now to the stage where international organizations are more important. The U.S. having such a strong army is actually a detriment to where the New World Order wants to go, erasing borders. But yet the intelligence agencies work across borders. And the interests that we fight for tend to be these global economic interests, oil in the Middle East, cheap labor around the world in China. You know, China's no longer really an adversary. China increasingly wants to invest in America. I wrote about this extensively in a book called America for Sale. We discussed it years ago, George. I think you face a reconfiguration. Jack Kennedy believed in the, you know, founding fathers' idea of original individual liberty, private property, the right of a person to, you know, command their own home, their own life as their castle, their destiny. Whereas the New World Order crowd wants the directions to come on high, and if you don't, and if you stray from the script, you're dispensable.
All right, to the phones we go. Andy's in Los Angeles to get us started here. Andy, you're on with Jerry Corsi. Go ahead.
Yes. George, thanks for having the courage, as well as Jerome having the courage to stand up and speak the truth.
You're welcome. Always.
The question is this. Didn't the Federal Reserve have the most to lose of all the different entities that were against Kennedy? And secondly, didn't Kennedy's son have that George magazine that was about to have an expose, like you're having, on who really killed his father? Before and then suddenly a week or 2 weeks before the magazine came out, he suddenly had a terrible accident. I appreciate all the information. Thank you.
Well, yes, whether the Federal Reserve had the most to lose, it certainly had a lot to lose. Kennedy was in the process of printing those red sealed Treasury notes. Kennedy realized that the Federal Reserve is not a government institution. It's a private bank. It's charging us for our money. Kennedy was going to put an end to that. I think Kennedy would have ended the Federal Reserve and started printing money out of the Treasury, which we could easily do today, and it would solve many problems. We've lost control of our money to a group of private international bankers. And yes, John Kennedy Jr. with George was in the process of publishing exposés and getting ready to publish exposés. They talked about it just before he died or was killed in the airplane accident, the fatal airplane accident, which remains suspicious even today. I haven't investigated as thoroughly, but I do have my suspicions over that airplane accident.
Who benefits? There are no coincidences. Jerry,
precisely,
two questions.
And that's why the argument about Lyndon Johnson being one of the conspirators is so powerful, especially knowing that the Kennedys were going to replace Lyndon Johnson on the ticket in 64. You've got to always ask in these issues, who benefits, George? You're right.
How long did they seal up the Kennedy file?
Well, you know, one of the many files are still sealed. The CIA is still hiding away.
50 years later.
Yes, and this, again, should be to the American public a clear indication the CIA's guilt and has something to hide. 50 years after the event, there's no excuse for not really. We should have every document of the Kennedy assassination revealed. Any agency that doesn't want to reveal the truth and the documents should be closed tomorrow. American people should demand this.
And I assume they've had 50 years to shred a lot of documents, Jerry.
No doubt about it, George. There's been, I'm sure, much sanitation of the documents, but yet there's got to be valuable material there or it would have been released. And there are some who know. The documents will be hard to just doctor or destroy, but they must be released. We must see everything, including all the autopsy records, all the notes, all the suppressed material, all the background material on the Warren Commission. The American public deserves a complete and full disclosure today, 50 years after the assassination of JFK.
We go to Gary in Tampa, Florida. Welcome to the program, Gary. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening, or good morning, I guess, both of you. This is fascinating. I really do appreciate you talking about this. I wanted to ask you about a documentary I saw on Hulu called America's Drug War, and they had interviews with ex-CIA agents, ex-DEA, and they maintained, they had some pretty good evidence that the CIA was involved in the importation of tons of cocaine on CIA DC-3s into Southern California in the early 80s, which then, of course, became the crack explosion, and that they used the funds that they got from this to initially fund the Contras in Nicaragua. And then subsequent to that, they started selling the weapons to Iran, and that George Bush, of course, H.W. was the vice president during this, and during, I believe, the Ford administration, he was CIA director, and they maintained that he put all this together and that Oliver North was his general manager on the ground. And I just wanted to see if you had any comments on that, and I'll take my... I'll listen to him off the air. Thank you.
Okay, sure thing. Can you comment on that, Jerry?
I have not worked as extensively on that period of time, and also, by the way, the BCCI bank was involved.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. What I do in the Who Really Killed Kennedy is document that an assassin was picked up in Dallas, a Corsican assassin, well-known international hitman with a French background, who was participating even in 1963, with the CIA in the drug trade coming out of Vietnam and Southeast Asia that was known as the French Connection, the movie The French Connection through Marseille. And the CIA, this hitman by the name, his name was Mertz. The CIA released a document in which it was shown that Mertz was apprehended on November 22nd in Dallas and let go by the INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service. That we had an internationally known assassin present in Dallas that day.
Jeez.
Indicates to me, and validated, was probably there to supervise the team that did the shooting.
Sure. Or you may have been one of the three shooters.
Either one, George. And the CIA involvement in the drug trade is well known, and it's continuing. You should ask yourselves why it is that we are getting more heroin today out of Afghanistan than we did when the Taliban ran the country. And I encourage you to look at the CIA in answering the question.
Vince is in Livingston, Montana. You're on with Jerry Corsi, Vince. Go ahead.
Jerry, I think you've done a great job of laying out the motivation for killing of John Kennedy. But as I back engineer and try to forget everything that we've been programmed about the Kennedy assassination, try to just evaluate it from the only film that we have, I find the actions of Jackie Kennedy to be most strange, especially for me. The Building 7 moment of the Kennedy assassination is when Jackie crawls out on the hood of that car. Anybody that's ever been shot at knows that your first instinct is to get down. And I think that
she was looking for
brain to reexamine the possibility that Jackie had worked for the CIA in 1952, that she had spent a month in Greece in September prior to the assassination, and that she was a trained assassin known as the Pink Panther, and she used Guns and Roses to deliver her goods.
Well,
all right. Jerry,
let's sort
ahead.
Through that. First of all, I've known people very close to Jackie Kennedy, and I had met Jackie Kennedy a couple of times and studied her very closely. I do not believe Jackie Kennedy was involved in the assassination. She got out in the back of the car because she was in a complete panic, and she was looking for the pieces of Jack Kennedy's head to put them back together. Jackie Kennedy was in Greece with Aristotle Onassis, and her sister, who was having an affair with Aristotle Onassis just before the assassination. In fact, Jackie had lost a baby very close to that time, and she was emotionally recovering. I think it's when her emotional attachment to Onassis began. Neither Jack or Jackie were necessarily faithful to each other in the relationship. And so there certainly could be sexual issues involved that were beginning at that time.
She wasn't an assassin, though, was she?
No, but she was not an assassin. She had no place, no role in the assassination. She was shocked, in tremendous grief. Jackie Kennedy's role was played straight, and the reason she got on the back of the car was because she was in an absolute panic. She was trying to save her husband and put his head back together. It was an irrational move, but an emotional move. Anyone who's had a bone broken may have experienced the initial impulses just to put the bone back and it'll all be okay. It doesn't work that way, but it is a psychological response. Jackie Kennedy was a victim, every bit as much as her husband was a victim.
I had heard a theory that Onassis might have been involved, Jerry, because he wanted Jackie.
Well, Onassis's true involvement with Jackie began deeply after the assassination. As I said, they had this Jackie's sister, Lee Ranzawell, was involved romantically with Onassis when Jack was alive. And Jackie went with her sister and met Onassis on his yacht just before the assassination. But I don't believe that Jackie was having an affair with Onassis at that time. I believe it started later. And Jackie was attracted to very powerful men. She came from a father, Black Jack, his name was, who had never had money, even though he was part of the old aristocracy. And Jackie needed and wanted emotionally someone like a Jack Kennedy or richer like an Onassis that could provide for her. And she was attracted to these men. But Jackie Kennedy, I believe, the day of the assassination, was deeply traumatized, deeply shocked. She never recovered from it, and she was a victim. She had no role in the killing of her husband.
We go to Kyle in Los Angeles now. Kyle, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to talk to Jerry.
Yep, you've got him.
I also like to say hi, Captain George. How you doing?
Good, Kyle. Thank you.
I'd like to ask Jerry, because I'm a shooter, and me and my father, who's also a shooter, and our friend in Arkansas, who's a shooter, we've looked at the situation, and he shot 180 yards using a 6.5 by 52 millimeter high pressure round. Now, we all believe that this Marine, with previous assassination experience, could have made this shot. I mean, I think I could have made it. My dad could have made it. My little sister could have made it, really. What are your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, I think it would have been very difficult with the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, which was not accurate, and the scope was not accurate. And, in fact, the rifle had a defective clip in it.
And we're talking about three shots, not just one.
And three shots in that time frame with the rifle, manually bolt-driven, is virtually impossible, and it's impossible for those shots each to be sighted. In fact, at that distance, the sight would have been a detriment. It would have been harder to use than if the rifle had no sight. Most experts who have studied, including Jesse Ventura and others, have found it virtually impossible to replicate this shooting feat of three shots that precisely, two of which were hits, according to the Warren Commission, being done with that weapon, the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, by anyone, even the top expert shooter. The ballistics also indicate a shot from the front, as we discussed earlier in the show, and I'd like to make the point, again, that the back wound was very shallow, about one tip of a finger, the index finger. The neck wound, closer to the book depository. There's no evidence that it exited the body, yet the headshot exploded the head. So it would seem that, again, different caliber ammunition or different types of ammunition were used to make these different shots. And you don't change weapons in the middle of shooting, not in that 5.8 or 7-second interval you've got where you're making a minimum of three shots and maybe more. So I don't think the evidence is there that this, and besides, if the shooter was in the sixth floor window, not just a decoy to throw people off in the sixth floor window, the best shot was directly below when the car was turning onto Elm Street, not waiting until the car was receding at a distance, going at a road, declining at a 3-degree angle on an S turn behind the tree. It is not an arcade game. You take your best shot if you're the sniper.
We now go to Gary in Ypsilanti, Michigan, first-time caller. Good morning, Gary.
Hi, how you doing? Mr. Corsi, could you speak to the folks about the Bush connection, how Prescott Bush fled Germany, came here to the U.S., was arrested, and then a brief investigation, then let go. And we've got how many political figures, major political figures, here in the U.S. that's out of his lineage?
Well, the major investigation I've done on Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker is the two of them were partners in the Harriman Brothers firm, which is the family of Double Averill Harriman. And that firm with the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, who were lawyers and investment bankers, they were financing Hitler prior to World War II. And there's no doubt that the Bush family was involved in that and running a bank in the United States and other industries in the United States in conjunction with Nazi Germany.
USB Bank, wasn't it?
It was called Union Bank. And it was shut down by FDR in the early days of World War II. And Alan Dulles continued to do this. Alan Dulles worked out of Bern, Switzerland during the war. Starting in 1943, Alan Dulles started moving the Nazi money into the stock market in the United States with the cooperation of Bormann, who was number two to Hitler, Hitler's secretary at that time.
What did these guys do after the fact, Jerry? Think about that. We'll come back. Final segment to go with Jerry Corsi on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. Okay, I'm going to be in New York tomorrow broadcasting from the Big Apple. Why? Because Thursday morning, I'm going to be on The View with Whoopi Goldberg talking about the paranormal and ghosts and all those other great things. So look for your ABC television station Thursday whenever The View runs in your particular market or city and have a little look at the show. I'm going to have some fun with that. The View. But the program tomorrow night originates out of New York. We'll be back in a moment with Jerry Corsi. We'll take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Jerry Corsi and the rest of your phone calls as well as we talk about his work, Who Really Killed Kennedy. And Jerry, this is your first major interview with this work. People are going to want this book. Where do they get it?
Thanks, George. And it's just published today or Tuesday. Today is Wednesday now. But the book is available all over in bookstores throughout the country. Who Really Killed Kennedy. My name, Corsi, C-O-R-S-I, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, WorldNet Daily, where I'm a senior staff reporter. The WND Superstore has copies where I've signed book plates, and those book plates are put into the book.
All right, let's go to Ray now in North Hollywood, California, to get us going this segment. Hi, Ray. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing, man?
Good, Raymond. Thank you.
How you doing, Jared? Hey, great show tonight, man.
Great. Thank you, Raymond. Thank you.
No problem. Just wanted to give you guys some info. There's a YouTube video, actually, that I guess has been recently uploaded and enhanced, where you can actually see the driver turn around, and you clearly see the pistol as he shoots Kennedy in the head. And I believe, I mean, if you look at the video, I mean, it's just undoubtedly, I mean, it's exactly as you see it, you know, and it's amazing. And I believe the alleged name is William Cooper. I don't know if you have any info.
Oh, yeah. Sure know him. And William was shot in a little dispute with the sheriff's deputies.
That video, it's been studied extensively, and the driver did not shoot Kennedy. There was no pistol. It is a glare from the sun on the person next to him, their head. The driver did turn around, which was inappropriate. The driver should have been speeding up. But
just gone, yeah.
Exactly, but did turn around to watch the shocking events and was totally caught off guard. Later in the video, the driver hunkers down low into the driver's seat and does speed up, but the reaction was inappropriate. And but there was no Secret Service attempt to kill John Kennedy. That's the glare you see in the sun. It's been thoroughly studied.
Ken is in Houston now. He's to the Rockies. Go ahead, Ken. Thank you.
Good evening.
Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, yes, can you hear us, Kenny?
Oh, yes, thank you. Good evening or good morning, George and Jerry.
Yes.
George, you interviewed an author of Dr. Mary's Monkey some time back. Remember that?
Long time ago, yes.
And there was some mention of Oswald in his book and to the fact that when he was in the Dallas police station, he was hollering that he was, or I say hollering, he was making a statement that he was set up, he was a patsy for this. And in this book, it goes into it, he was working for a government agency back then and working as a chauffeur for one of the doctors.
Yeah, that was one of Jim Mars's works, Jerry.
Yes, it was Judith Barry Baker, who also wrote a book called Me and Lee. She came out later into the whole issue, and her books are very interesting and very convincing. I'm not sure that they're fully documented. There's two problems. You know, she came out late, and there may be a good deal of invention in what she says. Secondly, if you do take seriously the work done by Armstrong on the two Oswalds, and I think there's a good case to be made that the government agencies were substituting an alternative identity in, at times, representing to be Oswald. Certainly that's the case in the trip to Mexico, which we have not had time to discuss, but it's hard to say which Oswald that was, if in fact the relationship was there. At any rate, the idea that Oswald was saying he was a patsy is actually on film during one of the clips when Oswald's being taken through the halls of the Dallas Police Department. He does say on camera, "I'm just a patsy."
I'm just a patsy. He sure did. You know, when we were talking about those who supported Hitler,
yes.
When we finally went to war with the Nazis, what did they do, those supporters?
Well, in fact, some of them continued to support Hitler and had to be shut down by Franklin Roosevelt, including grandfathers, the founding fathers of the Bush family and the Dulles family and their investment banker friends in Union Bank, operating in the United States as a Nazi bank. Alan Dulles went to Bern, Switzerland, and continued to work with the Nazis. The United States did not want to go to war against the Nazis. We went to war against the Japanese. Hitler declared war on the United States. And the business interests between the United States and Nazi Germany continued during the war, such that Alan Dulles, starting in 1943, was working with Bormann, number two to Hitler, Hitler's secretary, to move money into the U.S. stock market, to move money into Argentina. And there were even attempts to negotiate an end to the war, except that Hitler would not accept an end to the war, and the United States pressed for unconditional surrender. So the Dulles family made the best to salvage the pieces. We brought Nazi scientists here in the Operation Paperclip. We helped Nazis escape. We top Nazis. And we brought the Galen organization, the Gestapo, that was investigating a secret police for Hitler, the Russians. We made them one of the pillars around which we built the CIA. I've argued that we, in many ways, became the Nazis at the end of the war.
Well, we probably have. I mean, that whole situation is abominable. Some of them should have been arrested for treason.
And we lied about it. I've searched in the archives. I've written about it. I wrote about it when I wrote The Great Oil Conspiracy, how many of the Nazis making synthetic oil we brought into the United States after the war. And the files say this guy's still a Nazi. He hasn't changed. And we brought them into the United States anyway. We wanted their technical knowledge. We overlooked Wernher von Braun, the space program and the missile program that they had built, the V-2, and Wernher von Braun knew it and participated in it with Jewish slave labor in concentration camps. Countless numbers of people who died building those missiles in Jewish concentration camps and the Holocaust, which is one of the great human tragedies of all time. And yet we forgave that and overlooked it because we wanted Wernher von Braun and his rocket team to help us with our space program and our intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Let's go to Los Angeles. Hello, Rita.
And we lied to the American people, too, about it. That's the last part of it. Yes.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Rita.
Thank you for taking my call. By the way, I am calling you literally right across the street, unfortunately, where Bobby Kennedy got assassinated.
Yes.
What used to be the Ambassador Hotel.
Ambassador Hotel.
Right. But I, too, was calling to remark about this video that I saw on YouTube, but I want to break it down in a little more detail, if I may. I think it's very clear, at least in the footage that I had studied and looked at many times over, you could clearly see the limo driver turn back around, kind of, it almost looked like he was aiming his shot, and then turn his head straight, and then a second later, you see a gun come out on the side of his face, and then that's when Kennedy's head goes back. And then the other thing that was kind of interesting about that happening right before it happened, I noticed the governor in the front seat leaning over. At first he turns his body, and then he leans all the way into his wife or whoever the woman was beside him, as if to, you know, not be hit, like he knew that was going to happen. So both of those things I just thought were pretty remarkable when I viewed this video so many times.
Yes, that film has been studied extensively, and the driver did not have a gun, and the driver in the Secret Service did not kill Jack Kennedy. It's a reflection of the sun on the hair of the Secret Service agent sitting next to him. It looks like a gun. It's not. It has been studied. And Governor Connally was not aware of the assassination attempt. He maintained he was hit by a different bullet than hit Jack Kennedy in his throat and his back. And it was a second shot that Connally thought hit him. But Connally was a victim in the shooting, just as Jack Kennedy was. So I know that video looks very convincing, but you have to do some research on it. You'll find that it has been debunked, and the Secret Service is not complicit in having pulled out a weapon and shot Jack Kennedy. It did not happen.
Jerry, did you hear about this latest book that came out a few weeks ago, that Kennedy was not the target of this assassination?
No, I haven't heard that, but that, again, makes no sense at all. I mean,
no.
Jack, there were three attempts to kill Jack Kennedy in November 1963. We've discussed them. They've been fully documented, including references in the House assassination investigation, a book by Waldron and Tom Hartman. Several books have fully documented this and excellent research. They were all done with a patsy. They were all aimed at killing Jack Kennedy. They were all plotted by a combination of the CIA and the mob. The third attempt worked in Dallas. The other two did not work. They failed and were called off.
They had probably three plans then, didn't they?
Yes, but the three plans were very similar, and the patsies were all very similar. They were all ex-military. They were all about the same age. They were all going to be identified as shooters with a high-powered rifle and a scope from a tall building on the motorcade. There were the modus operandi of the Dallas killing was the same in the unsuccessful attempt in Chicago and in Tampa, and modeled after the Guatemala coup d'etat that was engineered by E. Howard Hunt and the CIA in 1954-1957.
Let's go to Lake Oswego in Oregon. John's with us, first-time caller. Hey, John, go ahead.
I have one comment and one question for the guest.
Sure thing.
My question is, was not Richard Nixon in Dallas before JFK's plane landed? And he was talking, I can't remember who he was talking to, and he left real quick. And my question and my comment is that on the third shot, when John Kennedy got hit in the head, all the splatter went behind and his head went back. Now, I shoot guns. I've shot deer, everything else. He was shot from the front. Anybody that has any experience in shooting a rifle knows how that works. The bullet goes in small and comes out big.
Yeah, that's true. It's amazing.
We agree. Headshot, I think there was a double headshot, one from the back almost simultaneously with one from the front, but the shot from the front happened second, and it did was an entrance wound from the front and an exit wound out the back of Jack Kennedy's head, and it did throw him violently to the left back on the seat. That was a shot from the front, and it was recognized as such at Dallas Hospital, at Dallas Parkland Hospital. Also, I do discuss at length in the book that Richard Nixon was in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. He was there to supposedly attend a soft drink convention where he was working with the company. And Nixon lied about it. He left after the assassination. And I make the argument in the book that Nixon was aware of the assassination plot, was there, and benefited from it. Within days, Nixon was holding a political meeting with his top advisors in New York, deciding, now that Jack Kennedy was dead, how did that advantage his next attempt to run for the presidency?
Exactly. And he elected, of course, not to run in 64.
Yes.
But he came out in 68.
And Jack Kennedy being eliminated the major rival that Nixon would have faced. And Nixon did not want to run against Johnson, who was going to be representing the martyred president. It was going to be very hard to beat Johnson after the assassination in 64. And Nixon thought he'd bide his time and run the next time, which he did, and he ran successfully.
That's right. Hubert Humphrey, right?
With Hubert Humphrey in 1968.
Let's go to Doug in Richland, Washington. Welcome to the program, Doug. Go ahead.
Hello, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Corsi, you're one of my favorite guests, and I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
I would like to share with you, I've tried and tried and tried to call whenever you've had a JFK assassination night to share a non-scientific realization on my part of how I decided that, personally, that Lee Harvey Oswald never even pulled the trigger.
All right, go for it.
In 1994... I found myself, it's a long story, but I'm going to make it completely short. I found myself on what they call the sixth floor. That is the school book depository, with it all being modernized, and they've got amazing things there and a maze that you go through and everything else. About halfway through, you find yourself near the corner of the building next to the window that supposedly Lee Harvey Oswald shot from his sniper's nest. You can't get to that corner exactly, but you can stand about 8 feet away, one window away from it, and look down into the street.
Right.
Well, I found myself there looking down into the street and imagining myself as a sniper. It was a beautiful day. There were cars, there were convertibles going down the street, and I have hunted all my life, shot small animals, big animals, the whole nine yards, and I am looking down there, and I am imagining a car going away from me on what I think they call LBJ Freeway. That's Elm Street, I believe.
Elm Street, yes.
In any case, after a few minutes, I realized that that is virtually an impossible shot.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. Jerry, we are rapidly out of time. Good luck with this work, and thank you for allowing us to be the exclusive on your presentation.
I really appreciate it, George. It's the first interview of any national significance in the book, and I want to commend you for all the years in which you and Coast to Coast have brought more information to the American public on the JFK assassination than anyone else, in my opinion, in media, with some historic programs, including the one with Hunt St. John, St. John Hunt, where you broadcast the first time the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt. You've just done magnificent work on this, George, and I'm honored to be with you tonight.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry Corsi, name of the book, of course, Who Really Killed Kennedy? And, of course, during the assassination around November 22nd, we'll, of course, do a assassination program for you as well. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.